I'd first like to both thank and congratulate the organizers of the conference who have facilitated a very smooth journey and session for me. And it's not easy to organize an event of this scale, especially without the support and resources of business in the state. So I think it's really admirable. So I just want to start with that. And I'd also like to thank you for coming and for your interest in what I have to say. The description of the talk and the subtitle of my book talk about race and class, a pairing that we hear a lot about now, questions about the relation between them and the political consequences of that relation, however it is understood. I think we get drawn into what I consider a very fruitless discussion a great deal of the time, which revolves around what I will call geometrical relations between race and class. It's as though there were two warring factions of geometers in ancient Greece, who each had a doctrine. And so there's first the doctrine of lines. So in two-dimensional Euclidean space, lines are either parallel or they are not. And so the doctrine of lines is the mode of explanation which social relations are defined according to lines not being parallel. Second, there's a doctrine of circles. And this is defining society as a set of points with a single point at the center. And so all phenomena are defined by their equal distance from the single central point. Now, I think that society can't be explained by two-dimensional shapes. And this is a good thing for me because I came close to failing geometry. And I think that what we have to understand is that abstract categories like race and class don't just name phenomena that exist out there in simple and isolable forms. They're used to produce knowledge about aspects of a complex structure, which is too complex to be captured in two dimensions. Now, this is the argument of Karl Marx in the 1857 Introduction to the Grundrisse, an important and one of the only analyses, one of the only presentations of his later materialist method. He points out that seemingly simple categories like labor or production are not actually simple. They're the result of complex processes. So instead of reducing the complexity of concrete reality to a simple category, we have to take this abstraction and add back all of the complex factors that have produced it. Now, there are many ways that we could pose the question about the relation between race and class, and this is often underlying, as I said before, the attempts to determine whether one causal factor is more important than another. But I think this is a false question. And I don't think that the supposedly Marxist response would consist in saying that class is more fundamental than race. After all, how do you measure something like that? Once again, we've got the problem of mathematical explanations. And despite all the math that you'll find in the three volumes of Capital, ultimately Marx's theory of the capitalist mode of production is not mathematical. To illustrate the point, we don't say that the morning of the working day is devoted to reproducing labor power and that then surplus value is produced after lunch. It doesn't work like that. Now, when it comes to race and class, the attempt to assign greater causality to one factor or another, we could imagine a statistical analysis. 65% of the tobacco produced in colonial Virginia was produced by capitalism and 35% by white supremacy. Equally absurd. Now, while few people are likely to explicitly endorse mathematical explanations of this kind, we still encounter this metaphysical insistence on finding the final cause, which is out there somewhere once we get rid of all the extra inconvenient facts that get in the way. Another question that is frequently posed is whether capitalism needs racism, as though capitalism was a Silicon Valley investor who needs a fresh glass of kombucha every morning. To even pose the question of whether capitalism needs something or not is based on the premise that there might be a history of capitalism other than the one that actually happened, as though we could formulate an abstract definition and measure reality against it. Now, here's how that method of thinking goes. The essence of capitalism is hard to grasp because it has appeared in so many different places and has changed so much over time. So you have to carve away all the accidental and excess phenomena and construct an ideal model. So then, according to this method, you determine the relation between race and class at the level of the model, and maybe you find that race is of secondary importance to class or that capitalism doesn't need racism. That's the method. But you also don't fix the problem if you say, yes, capitalism does need racism because of labor market differentiation or absolute surplus value or something like that, because you're still trapped in the same idealist method. So let me repeat that these abstract categories are not objects which exist out there in the world that we can simply name or define. And so the relation between race and class cannot be determined at this level of abstraction. What exists out there is a concrete reality with a complex structure, and it develops unevenly, as opposed to a simple expression of an essence which develops in a linear way. What do I mean by this? Well, social phenomena are not expressions of some unitary essence. It's not like a Christmas present that you unwrap and find the economy hidden underneath the wrapping. It's not that Marx came down the chimney and left you the economy under a tree, and now you can explain everything. After all, the economy itself is constituted by political and legal relations. Marx was clear about this. It arises with the dissolution of the feudal estates. It comes about through the recognition of the rights-bearing individual, and so on. The economy is not simple. It's complex, and you only have to flip through Capital to see that there is nothing simple about it. Now, this concrete reality is also complex because it does not develop evenly over time. A historical change of one thing does not constitute a total change of all the intertwined elements. So, it's a mistake to say that because of the abolition of slavery or legal desegregation that the race factor has diminished and now there are only pure questions of class. And it's crucial to be aware of what Marxists have called survivals. For example, the relations generated by racial slavery survived as sharecropping and Jim Crow. And now, even after legal segregation has been formally abolished, segregation survives in housing markets and a whole other range of relations, ranging from legal relations to everyday habits. So again, to repeat, race and class are not essences that exist out there, but concepts we produce in order to understand specific aspects of this complex and uneven structure. In order to understand them, we can't try to define them in the abstract, but instead have to move towards studying specific social instances to understand their relation in concrete reality. With these methodological notes in mind, I will proceed to talking about what I describe in the book as racial ideology. So, along the lines of what I've been saying, I insist that there is no such thing as race, but only specific regimes of racialization. That is, first of all, race has no biological or civilizational reality. It is a false way of understanding variation in human beings, and it falsely equates nature and culture as functions of this variation. If we believe that race is real, then we are in the realm of racial ideology, which obscures the real social relations that produce it. So, I have never aspired to, and I reject the goal of providing a general theory of race, which is a notion internal to racial ideology. Instead, I think we need concrete analyses of the production of race. Now, Stuart Hall wrote a very important article called Race Articulation and Society Structured in Dominance, drawing on the same methodological writings of Marx that I've been talking about. And he said, to theorize racially structured social formations, you have to begin with the premise of historical specificity. That is, you don't deal with racism as a general feature of human societies, but with historically specific racisms. That's Hall from this article, which I recommend reading. So there may certainly be commonalities to these different social formations, but if you begin with commonalities, you get stuck in the same idealist trap. So going from the abstract to the concrete means adding in all the historical factors which take apart this totalizing ideology of race. We might find different notions of race throughout history, but we have to understand how they fit into specific social formations and how they get reconfigured when other relations in the social formation are transformed. So race is not transhistorical, and it also must not be understood as real, except insofar as any ideology refers to real social relations, is produced by real practices and institutions, and has real effects. So in this sense, racial ideology is imaginary. It's a representation of the way that we live our relation to real conditions. And what it represents is the division of populations into groups based on arbitrary physical characteristics such that certain people are subjected to increased violence and exploitation. In other words, racism is real as a social relation, and it produces an ideology of race, of biological and civilizational difference, which is false, yet has real effects, and reproduces the social relations of racism. In my book, I look at the concrete case of race in the United States. And I have argued that the primordial form of race is the white race. And there are many ideologies of skin color, bone structure, religion, and so on that predate the situation in colonial Virginia, that come from elsewhere, and they have an influence on what is happening during the capitalist transition in the colonial US. But the invention of the white race generates a specific complex structure of exclusion, subordination, and violence that lasts into the present. So the racial ideology of the United States is a complex phenomenon which integrates previous ideologies and reconfigures them in combination with new political, legal, and economic relations. I think that this particular racial ideology has been generalized through imperialism. And even in other international contexts, the language of race is used in a way that is embedded in the racial ideology of the United States. But other specific situations will be different. So we can't speak about all of them at once, the general theory of race. So what we should do is maintain that the method of analysis should operate on the premise of historical specificity, as Hall pointed out, rather than being general and transhistorical. Now that is why I am critical of the association of identity with race. Now it's well known that the term identity politics was advanced within a specific political situation by the Combahee River Collective, and it functioned as a critique of the colorblind and genderblind left, and it was directed towards proposing a revolutionary politics. I think that this important intervention should not be assimilated into racial ideology. If identity becomes a general category, rather than the highly specific category of black feminism that as it originated, if it becomes transhistorical and all-encompassing, we have totally lost the specificity we need to criticize racial ideology. What's more, identity has a particular function within racial ideology. It associates race with the experiential phenomena of self-definition, group belonging, and social recognition and misrecognition. Now, these experiential phenomena are vitally important, but they do not explain the complex processes that have assigned people to so-called races. And I think that the language of identity obscures these complex processes and therefore reproduces the logic of the existing society. But there's an equally serious problem on the other pole, which we can associate with what some people call class reductionists, which is fine. It's fine to call it class reduction. I'm referring now to those who think that class has a unique objective and material reality, while race is mere identity and therefore not material. That's actually a kind of idealism, because it means accepting racial ideology at its face instead of understanding the material relations that have generated it. It's assuming that real social relations have no material reality. That's idealist, actually. Now, I'll take this a little further, provocatively, and point out that class reductionism is itself a kind of identity politics. Now, I don't mean this in the glib way, that class is also an identity, or that all politics are identity politics, or something like that. Remember, I don't think that race should be understood as an identity either. But the reason that I think class reductionism is a kind of identity politics is that it revolves around gaining the working class greater recognition, redressing its injuries, and winning a more equitable distribution of resources. In this sense, it's an affirmation of the identity of the working class. However, the most basic premise of Marxist thought and politics is that the program of the proletariat is the abolition of all classes, including the proletariat itself. So the tendency of affirming a particular kind of group definition that is implied by class identity politics is completely contrary to the program of proletarian revolution, which involves its self-abolition. Unfortunately, many socialists do subscribe to this kind of class identity politics, and some even have the audacity to claim a grounding in Marx, when Marx explicitly rejected the idea that he was affirming the dignity of labor, or in any way conceiving of the proletariat as an interest group. In fact, he began with the idea that the proletariat was the negation of the existing society. So I'll turn now to class specifically to see what this means. Okay. So, first of all, a point which should not be controversial among Marxists is that class is not merely a category of the distribution of wealth. That is the understanding of classical liberal political economy. Rather, class is defined in terms of the forms of property. And what's important for me in the analysis I'm going to present is that in Marxism, class appears in two forms. First, as a category of social analysis. At this level, a definition in terms of forms of property. But second, very importantly, as a political subject, the agent of emancipation. So the social analysis of forms of property is supposed to be the foundation for the political subject of emancipation. Now here, I must point out Marxism has encountered many difficulties. Because the unity of these two forms of class was supposed to be guaranteed by a historical process which was practically automatic. That is, the consciousness of class had to be spontaneously generated by the labor process, and that a particular definition of class internal to the existing society, which is a hegemonic sector of the exploited, the industrial proletariat, would become the basis for a break with what already exists. This is the key problem and tension that I'm pointing to in the history of Marxism. And this complex understanding of class, the tying of the social analysis to the political subject, is a unique development in the history of modern socialism. So in the form of utopian socialism in the early 19th century, politics was centered on businessmen who saw themselves as engaged in philanthropy. They were interested in popularizing their message among workers, but nothing more than that. There was no intrinsic connection between socialism and class struggle. It didn't signify a program, but rather a particular view of human nature, which emphasized the fundamental importance of sociability or social instincts within it. And it implied an organization of society that emphasized cooperation and social action and intervention in the existing market, but this did not necessarily mean collective ownership of wealth. As time went on, it became clear that this outlook would align with those who believed in equality, in the manner of the extreme left of the French Revolution, and that this agenda would come into conflict with property rights. On the other side was the labor movement in the 19th century. One of the most typical cases was Chartism in England, which was based on the People's Charter, and the movement used the tactics, familiar tactics, of strikes, petitions, and mass meetings, because the right to assemble was not guaranteed. But the reforms that the Charter aimed at were specifically based on increasing democracy and winning democratic rights, so suffrage, secret ballots, and so on. For most of its existence as a movement, there was nothing about socialism. Was a matter of deepening democracy to represent the excluded part of society, which was the working class. So it's in this context that Marxism emerges and fundamentally transforms what socialism means and what class means. Now this is happening in the course of a concrete process of social reorganization through the 16th to 19th centuries. And there are two uneven yet intertwined strands to the process. First is the replacement of the absolutist state with the organizational form of modern parliamentary democracy. And this results both from contradictions within the ruling classes and from the pressures of uprisings from below. It means the introduction of the universal ideals of liberty and equality, which have their material basis in these institutional transformations, like the transfer of political power from the monarch to elected parliamentary representatives, and the extension of rights to citizens, including the right to vote, the right to hold property, and the right to freedom of speech and belief. Now, we have to be cautious and understand that this is not an expression of some kind of idea of democracy, whether it was in classical liberalism or dating back to ancient Greece or something like that. It was the reorganization of existing oligarchic structures to incorporate representative institutions to manage the crisis that they were experiencing. But the effect of the new institutions was indeed to make it possible for new social groups to express their demands in the public sphere and potentially implement them through the contestation of political power. Now, the second process, which has an uneasy relationship to these democratic developments, is the emergence of capitalism. Pre-capitalist feudal societies had organic political hierarchies which regulated both the power to govern and the way people met their subsistence needs. With capitalism, these organic political hierarchies were reorganized into the separate spheres of the political and the economic. And this was the result of major processes of dispossession which separated people from the means of subsistence and rendered them dependent on the market in the form of industrial workers, but also as servants or slaves. Now, the capitalist transition, the meeting of subsistence needs was subordinated to the accumulation of abstract wealth in the form of money, which replaced the conquest of territory that defined feudal accumulation. And over the course of these centuries, the global population would be increasingly incorporated into the world market. So Marx, in his earliest writings, was trying to understand the social change taking place as he participated in movements to overcome the residues of the absolutist state. And he observed in his earliest writings that the new liberal conception of people as the bearers of universal rights was grounded in the social relations of the market, in which people acted as abstract, atomized individuals exchanging their property. But the contradiction of liberal society and the democratic revolutions that were bringing it into being was that these market relations foreclosed the human emancipation that the revolutions had promised. What had actually happened was that a particular economic class, the bourgeoisie, had come to represent its particular interests as the universal social interest and had achieved political domination to represent the whole of society. So Marx argued at this stage that real human emancipation could only be achieved by the new class that had emerged in opposition to the bourgeoisie, and this was the proletariat. So Marx's attention to the proletariat emerges within this context of understanding the broad historical changes taking place, and from the vantage point of emancipation, of the limits on existing political struggles for emancipation and the possibility of a different kind of emancipation. And it's at this point that he discovers, so to speak, the proletariat. And he argues that because of its absolute dispossession, the proletariat can only make the demand for the abolition of the whole structure of society. So instead of hegemonically representing its particular interests as a universal social interest in the manner of the bourgeoisie, it would genuinely represent the universal human interest of overcoming every form of domination, which had just come, had found in market society its most advanced and developed form. So rather than confining this to an economic theory or a theory of class struggle, though it is both of those two, we should understand it as a theory about fundamental political questions, including the classical question of political thought, which is who is fit to govern in a society. So the whole history of political thought poses this question, and it presents different ways of understanding who is fit to govern. So based on birth and lineage is the monarchist theory. Based on a level of education, this is actually the classical liberal theory, that the educated should govern. Either way, the underlying premise is that the majority is not fit to govern. Most people are not. Now, for Marx, the political achievement of the proletariat would be to overcome this question entirely. So real emancipation would be the abolition of any distinction between rulers and ruled. It would be the universal power to self-govern. And it's for this reason that for Marx, class struggle becomes the central political antagonism of modern societies. Not because class is more material than something else, or because it has some kind of physiological foundation in human nature, or anything of that kind. This is simply not how Marxist thought developed. It will take him another 20 years to define what classes are in the capitalist mode of production. Since this isn't transparently contained in the discovery of the proletariat as a revolutionary subject, and it's no longer based on the foundation of human nature. Certainly the young Marx talks about the category of the human, but he's really inherited it from the Critique of Religion that precedes him, and so it's better understood as a reference to what is generic, that is, what does not correspond to any particularity or identity. It's not for me or for you, but for anyone. And furthermore, this is the age of nationalism, which is producing national identities, and the universality of the proletariat is the basis for overcoming that kind of unambiguously non-emancipatory identity. And this universality will ultimately be expressed in the principle of internationalism of the communist movement. Now, in the transitional period of his writing between the young works and Capital, Marx develops an analysis of class which is inextricably tied up with the question of political organization. And that's a problem that his earlier analysis had not concretely addressed, because there's a very clear problem, very clear contradiction in the logic of the early writings, which is that if market society has reduced the proletariat to atomized, egoistic individuals, how will they achieve the unity necessary to carry out a revolution? So, in the Communist Manifesto, Marx and Engels present a kind of answer. They say that the forces of history are driving the proletariat towards greater unity, because workers are being brought together into towns and factories by industrial development. And as a result, they'll begin to form unions and struggle for better wages and conditions, and therefore not only improve their own lives, but more importantly, increase their unity for the final struggle in which they can seize power. But even then, this was a very distant goal, because the year that the Communist Manifesto came out, the role that was projected for the proletariat was to intervene in the continuing political revolutions against the vestiges of feudalism. This was the 1848 revolutions. And while the manifesto suggested that the forces of historical necessity would cause this to continue into a revolution against capitalism, it became clear that there was no such automatic process. And actually, class alliances between the petty bourgeoisie and the proletariat began to fracture. Democratic demands did not lead to a movement against private property, and the programs of the different class fractions came into open conflict. So the defeat of 1848, when the liberal forces of the middle classes turned against the interests of the working class, introduced a crisis in the automatic conception of revolution. Now, the original theory of organization in the manifesto relied on history's linear progression towards the transcendence of class society, driven by the development of the productive forces and its constant contradiction with the relations of production. And this theory had fragmented. Now, over the course of the 1850s and 1860s, Marx grew increasingly suspicious of this theory, the view that the forces of historical necessity would automatically result in revolution, and therefore in revolutionary organization. But there was no clear alternative. And in Capital, Marx presents a new analysis of the capitalist mode of production. And later in his Reflections on the Paris Commune, he presents a new understanding of the character of the society which will follow a revolution. But at no point does he present a new theory of organization or of the historical process which corresponds to these new insights. So, to repeat the points I began this with, Marxism identifies sociological and empirical objects, and one of them is class. But this is not quite the same thing as class as a political subject, because the theory of class as an object internal to the existing reality is not the same as the theory of class as a subject which will be capable of exiting the existing reality. So for class to function as an agent of revolution, it has to be part of a process of revolutionary transformation, which means the development of a political collectivity which aims at the overturning of the existing society and the egalitarian reorganization of human life. Now, without that, you may have various kinds of labor movements which improve living conditions for the majority of people, and so on. And they should absolutely be advocated and supported by any Marxist and socialist, but they cannot be equated with socialism. As we have seen, Marx considered the proletariat to be the agent of real human emancipation, and this was the vantage point from which he formulated a theory of class struggle. So I want to look now directly at emancipation. Now, just to retreat a little bit to the question of race and class, I think that As I've explained, I think that both categories are problematic in their own ways, theoretically and as categories of social analysis. But I think it also has to be understood that categories of this kind cannot be understood as a foundation for politics, even though they will be internal to any political movement or political struggle. Because I think attempting to answer the question at the level of social analysis of which category is more foundational, there's an urgency that people have in posing this question about the relation between race and class, is one more fundamental than the other and so on, because I think it seems as though it will provide a guarantee for political action. Once we've correctly determined the relation of race and class, we know what to say or do to mediate the various debates that are going on around us. But as I've just said, I think that the problem is that definitions of what already exists can't serve as the basis for realizing the exception to what exists, which is a form of human life which is beyond the market and the state. And I think we should be absolutely clear that it is fairly meaningless to describe oneself as a Marxist if one believes in the permanent existence of the market and the state. Now, if we look instead of abstract definitions at concrete social movements and their histories, we can see that they unify race and class in their analysis, because this was clearly the requirement for real emancipation. But they did so within the specificity of their situations, rather than engaging in generalizations. And they determined this from the vantage point of emancipation. So emancipation, I believe, is the starting point. It's not derived from social analysis or the guarantee of definitions. And to artificially claim the foundational priority of an abstraction like race or class is as counterproductive as expelling one altogether. And decisions about priorities and movements are made strategically and conjuncturally. And what counts is whether these particular practices of politics are formed with the goal of emancipation. And what I have criticized as identity politics in my book is a set of political practices around race that I consider to be non-emancipatory. There is no equation between them and race because there are emancipatory politics against racism. And there can be politics around class which are not emancipatory, which Marx and Engels criticized throughout their entire lives and throughout the history of contemporary socialism they've been criticized. So, these categories of social analysis, whether they're class, race, gender, or anything else, describe effects of the social structure. And when this social analysis is the starting point and consciousness is understood as the effect of social being, we remain at the level of what exists, and not the capacity of people to think of what is distinct and exceptional, what is in excess of that which exists. And so as a result, the attempts to give emancipation a foundation in a category of social analysis will always lead us back to what already exists. But the difficult problem, you know, is at the same time, the project of emancipation only exists in concrete and specified historical circumstances, and it deals with these categories of social analysis. And so politics exists in particular sequences which have a beginning and an end. They end when the existing procedures and aims have been exhausted. And there are two dangers, I think, in the moment of exhaustion. First, if the end of a political sequence is understood to be an indication of the futility and corruption of the whole project of emancipation, this leads to various forms of betrayal. Second, if there is an insistence on continuing a mode of politics specific to a historical situation that no longer exists, this reduces politics to pure nostalgia and wish fulfillment. You can go and look at the different books and identify which is which. I think we can describe these as various forms of depoliticization. I think that there is a danger now that despite the current flood of people into socialist organizations, that there is an underlying dynamic of depoliticization which we have not figured out how to address. And so there is a risk for contemporary socialism. It is that if socialism does not contest the premise of the permanent existence of the state and the market, it will be unable to think emancipation. Now, identity politics, as I've defined it, left and right-wing populism, contemporary social democracy, all belong to the general condition of depoliticization because they insist that a different organization of human life is unthinkable. So what is necessary to combat depoliticization is to adapt socialist theory and practice to real conditions, developing new programs, strategies, and forms of organization that are adequate to the historical situation while maintaining the orientation that something other than what exists is possible. Now, as I have suggested, Marx proposed a theory of emancipation which meant overcoming the classical conception of politics as the form of good governance, as the determination of who is fit to govern and how best to govern. This means that necessarily emancipation is based on the premise that everyone has an equal capacity for thought, and that they're already, within the existing society, capable of thinking not only of what exists, but of what is possible. So the only basis for emancipation is the everyday activity of people, not the people of the US Constitution or contemporary populism, which is a kind of identity politics of the dominant, but simply the generic people. This was captured very well in an article. This is captured very well in many places, but I was recently reading an article by the Brazilian activist Marielle Franco, who was murdered last year by former police officers in a possible conspiracy. And in this article in New Left Review called After the Takeover, published there in translation, she describes the creativity of black women in the favelas of Rio de Janeiro. So she says that despite the lived experience of inequalities, the women of the peripheries and the favelas are not defined by impoverished passivity, contrary to their representations in mainstream discourse and the media. So instead, she says, they have succeeded in making changes at a neighborhood level that make powerful claims as new sites for the popular imagination and for social relations, Residents in these communities organize themselves beyond the low public investment in their lives. These urban peripheries recognizably produce multiple forms of intelligence. And the question is contemporary socialism able to identify the production of multiple forms of intelligence by people, and is able to understand these as presenting a new possible, a possible organization of human life beyond the state and the market? Now, I think that there is no, by way of conclusion, there is no politics outside the concrete history of emancipatory movements, which is why they are most of the words in my book are devoted to talking about them. Because they establish the terms from which we begin. And the emergence of emancipatory politics is rare. It doesn't happen all the time, and we have to affirm its every appearance. And it's, I believe that Marx practiced this by drawing his understanding and his theory from political events, from the revolutions of 1848 to the Paris Commune. And I think that this is something that is, that I argue at greater length in the book, but the mass movements against racism of the 20th century United States were one of the most important political sequences in history. And so I'll end on the emancipatory ideas that they put forward. They were the self-organized expression of those who were excluded from the existing social structure, and they thus aimed at an absolutely egalitarian and self-governing organization of human life. And any meaningful definition of socialism corresponds to this. To understand why such movements fit within a socialist politics does not mean explaining how they somehow have something to do with class. No, that it's just illogical. And so a set of principles advanced by these movements which I think remain completely relevant. One, mass direct action as the regulating principle of political practice. We can think, you know, despite the recuperation of the civil rights movement by the mainstream today, by the state, the civil rights movement was a movement of mass direct action. It was a revolutionary movement. Okay, so first principle, mass direct action. Second, solidarity across every border, geographical or cultural. Even the tactic of civil disobedience was in a direct reference to the Indian independence struggle. Absolutely direct. It was always references to Vietnam are there in the 50s. Three, mutual aid as a means of forming a self-organized and militant collectivity. There was nothing new in Occupy doing mutual aid or something like that. It happened in churches, it happened in all kinds of organizational spaces before. Finally, for an intransigent insistence on pursuing justice without respecting the limits imposed by the state. Okay. And I think that those of us who aim at emancipation today should remain faithful to these principles. Thank you.